I'm Afshin Ratansian. Welcome back to Going Underground, broadcasting all around the world from the UAE. In a week that saw the most famous journalist in the world, Julian Assange, given a reprieve from de facto death in the USA, instead another 3 weeks, at least, of torture in London, as described by former UN Special Rapporteur Niels Meltzer on this programme. There has been another UN Special Rapporteur report, though. Rapporteur Francesca Albanese, in Anatomy of a Genocide, called for an immediate arms embargo of Israel and reparations to be paid to Gaza. Her designation of genocide, enabled by the USA, UK and EU nations, came after the UN Security Council, except for the USA, voted for a Ramadan ceasefire in Gaza after tens of thousands, mostly women and children, have been slaughtered, accompanied by NATO nation or NATO-facilitated aerial bombardment of Yemen, Iraq and Syria. Syria, of course, was one area where NATO nations incubated ISIS, blamed exclusively by NATO for last week's massacre at the Crocus City Concert Hall in Moscow, an atrocity backed by NATO-backed Ukraine authorities. One scholar who has backed Assange opposed US forever wars and refused to call the proxy war in Ukraine unprovoked is Professor Stephen Walt, author of Origins of Alliances and the Israel Lobby and US Foreign Policy, co-authored with Professor John Mersheimer. He is the Robert and Renee Belfer Professor of International Affairs at the Harvard Kennedy School and joins me now from Brookline, Massachusetts. Thank you so much, Professor Walt, for coming on. Before we get to the genocide, the US has given this 3 weeks. I know the case itself, the documents are labyrinthine. No one really seems to understand it. And top QCs, now KCs in Britain, have told me they've never seen anything like it. Why have you supported Julian Assange?
Well, because I don't believe Julian Assange committed espionage. He was operating much as journalists do. He received classified information that was leaked to him by people in the U.S. government. But that's no different than people leaking information to the New York Times. So to single him out as a particularly egregious case and to accuse him of espionage seems to me inappropriate. I might add that governments around the world, including the U.S. government, leak information when they want to journalists, when they're trying to advance a particular policy and they're trying to spin a story in a particular way. And given that Assange was, in my judgment, acting much in the same way that all journalists do, albeit in a different platform, to have singled him out in this way and threatened him with a long prison sentence, you know, possibly a life sentence, strikes me as just inappropriate. And if he were extradited and subsequently convicted in the United States, I think it will have a chilling effect on press freedom here in the United States, which would be unfortunate, because one of the things we expect the press to do, of course, is inform us about secrets that the government is trying to keep from us. And in particular, when those policies are going awry, the public needs to be informed about them. And of course, most journalists understand that. But if they can be thrown in jail for reporting information that is leaked to them by people inside the government, then I think it'll have a chilling effect on the rest of the media.
I know the papers of record there do support him, have written articles in favor of him, but surprised by how little attention has been given to the Assange case in the United States and for what it means for press freedom in the US, given that it means any conviction would open the doors to the jailing of the editor of the New York Times and the Washington Post and who knows who else?
I think part of the problem here, of course, is this case has taken a long time. It's been, you know, he's been incarcerated on various grounds. He was hiding out in the Ecuadorian embassy for many years. And in some respects, I think attention, you know, the short attention span of modern society has been such that his case has not gotten as much attention. He's been off the headlines. I believe if he is extradited, if the case goes through, he comes to the United States and he stands trial, then the case is going to get an enormous amount of attention, precisely because media organizations are going to be very worried about the implications.
Of course, it could be, because some of those journalists favor Biden in November, and it's a Biden Justice Department. But in the Biden administration, we've seen Annalene Chanel from the State Department, another State Department official who has resigned over the genocide in Gaza. Assange, you know, we had the UN Special Rapporteur on torture saying he's being tortured by British authorities. This week, we see a UN Special Rapporteur on Palestine, Albanese, calling out the war on Gaza as genocide. What has it done to the reputation of the United States all around the world? Just that lonely hand from the UN, U.S. Ambassador to the UN, Linda Thomas-Greenfield at the United Nations Security Council.
I think this has had an enormous negative effect on the American image, and it's exposed the inconsistency or the hypocrisy with which we talk about a rules-based order. In a sense, what we're seeing now is what America calls a rules-based order being juxtaposed against existing international law. So the United States abstains on a Security Council resolution, and before the ink is even dry, the American ambassador says, well, it's really not a binding resolution.
What did that
State
mean,
Department
Professor?
Spokesman.
What did
I
you
don't
mean?
Know.
But you're
I
an expert
no
at Harvard Kennedy School.
No, but I don't know why she said that, because I don't think that has any basis in international law. Right, UN resolutions, particularly those that use the kind of language that this resolution
at
did.
At the Security Council.
At the Security Council, saying that they demand an immediate ceasefire, et cetera, these are binding. Now, how you enforce them is a separate question, but they are considered binding, and the parties involved are supposed to adhere to them. So for the United States to abstain for it, to let it go through, a small shift in American policy, and then basically to refer to it as non-binding is a way of diluting what we had just done, essentially walking it back a little bit more. And the problem, of course, is around the world that makes us look deeply hypocritical, that this rules-based order we like to talk about is basically our making up the rules. And when we don't like an existing set of rules, we either ignore them or we expect them to be changed. And that's just not a very appealing image. So I think the combination of the way the United States has responded to the tragedy in Gaza and the way in which it is now talking about it has undercut the American image in all sorts of places.
I understand that a Chapter 7 resolution would authorize military force in backing a UN Security Council resolution, but does that mean then that this week we've witnessed the end of the United States participation in the UN project forged in 1945 then? I mean, it is a binding resolution. The UN themselves said, it's international law, that resolution 2728 for a ceasefire.
No, but I don't think... Yeah, I think that's taking it too far. The United States, of course, will continue to use the United Nations to try and advance its own interests the same way other countries do. The problem is that when you are egregiously inconsistent, this is going to undermine the sort of political capital that the United States has in many parts of the world. Doesn't make it impossible for the United States to elicit other countries' cooperation. It's just going to make it more difficult going forward. And I think we're already seeing that in a variety of different places. The fact, for example, that South Africa independently decided to bring its application to the International Court of Justice regarding a possible genocide in Gaza is a show of independence on the part of South Africa that you might not have expected in earlier eras. And I think it reflects unhappiness with how the United States and some other countries are responding not only to this crisis in general, but also to the basic state of the present world order.
Well, I referred to that resignation of the State Department. Do you think Antony Blinken understands what you were just saying there? Because the last I saw it, he was still talking about the fact Saudi Arabia would make a deal with Israel.
Now, I believe that Secretary Blinken is stuck in an outdated view of what's happening in the Middle East, and also I think feels caught, as the rest of the administration does, between a sort of a rock and a hard place. They are in a terrible bind. What they're doing, they understand it's doing damage to the American image abroad. They understand it might be causing sufficient unhappiness in parts of the United States and with the progressives in the United States that it threatens Biden's re-election. But they also understand that if they do the right thing and say cut off American support or threaten to cut off American support to Israel, they'll face a backlash from pro-Israel forces in the United States. So in a sense, they understand they're in a very difficult situation. My feeling is if you are going to be damned if you do, damned if you don't, you ought to do the right thing, both morally, but also in terms of advancing basic American interests. And that would be to be putting enormous pressure on Israel to stop what it's doing, agree to a ceasefire, get the hostages released, and then move forward to try and achieve a just solution in the Middle East.
Because I know you've been a fervent critic of the leading opposition contender in your country in November, Donald Trump. But Donald Trump writing in an interview in a newspaper owned by Sheldon Adelson, Hayom newspaper in Israel, said Israel is losing lots and lots of support. It's made a very big mistake. It'll catalyze anti-Semitism. I mean, that's the kind of words that, I don't know, I'd expect from a Stephen Walt article.
In this case, Donald Trump is right. I don't think that qualifies him to be our next president, but he's called that one correctly.
But how do you detect a difference there, given that he's so dependent on pro-Israel, pro-Netanyahu, pro-Zionism capital?
I'm not sure that's true. Right? Both political parties collect donations from pro-Israel forces and pro-Israel individuals. Trump has also got lots of other bases of support. And I think he, because he's going to be running against Biden, is looking for ways to distinguish himself from the Biden administration. And if he can do that, he's likely to win some support from people who are unhappy with how Biden has handled this particular crisis.
And you believe, though, that the public posturing that has been given out since 100,000 voters in the Michigan primary wanted no one as opposed to Biden in November, which you're saying is worrying the Democrats. Do you believe the posturing that there's this big difference between Biden and Netanyahu, or is that for the public and for the voting base while he continues to send ammunition, spare parts and weaponry to Netanyahu?
Yeah, I think that there are growing differences. I mean, just about every American president who's had to deal with Netanyahu has found him difficult to deal with. And for the Biden administration to have been so supportive of what Israel is doing, supportive in a material sense, but also, as we've talked about, protecting it in the Security Council, and then to be treated with essentially contempt by the Netanyahu administration, basically saying, well, thank you for your support and we're going to do what you want, is bound to annoy people.
Yeah, but previous presidents have said no to Israeli premiers, haven't
they? Yeah.
You might have to remind us of them.
Well, there's a number of cases when Israel had invaded Lebanon in the Reagan administration. Eventually, Reagan called up Menachem Begin and basically told him to stop, and the Israelis stopped the siege of Beirut at that point. So there have been a few moments where American presidents have been able to...
And I think Bush as well. So why doesn't Biden do that?
I don't know. To be perfectly honest, as I've said a number of times before, I think President Biden and Secretary Blinken are stuck with a sort of old image of Israel. I do think they're also worried about the political ramifications here. But as I said before, they're going to be hurt either way. Their concern, by the way, is not so much that public opinion will shift, although it is shifting. I think now a majority of Americans in polls are unhappy with how Israel is treating this. But I think the big worry for Biden is not only Arab American voters in a few key states, but also the left wing of the Democratic Party isn't going to vote for Trump, but they may stay home. They'll simply not turn out in the numbers that Biden is going to need. They're not going to help the campaign in the numbers that Biden would like to see. I think their hope is that you'll eventually get a ceasefire before the election. You can start trying to essentially spin this as a tragedy, but we're now moving forward, and it won't be front and center in the minds of many voters. I hope they are right in that. I'd like to see a ceasefire immediately, but whether or not that actually happens, I think remains to be seen, and I'm not actually all that optimistic.
Professor Stephen Walt, I'll stop you there. More from the Harvard Kennedy School Professor of International Affairs after this break.
When all truths seem wrong, when all rules just don't hold, and a new world is yet to shape out, disdain becomes the etiquette, and engagement equals betrayal. When so many find themselves worlds apart, we choose to look for common ground.
In 1941, with the Nazis' help, Croatian ultranationalists, the Ustashas, proclaimed the independent state of Croatia. Shortly after seizing power, they built the Jasenovac concentration camp, a place associated with the worst atrocities committed in Yugoslavia during World War II. The Ustashas used the camp system to isolate and exterminate Serbs, Roma, Jews and other non-Catholic minorities and political opponents of their fascist regime. Conditions in the Jasenovac camp were horrendous. The guards tortured, terrorized and murdered prisoners.
They send them in concentration camps. So most of them died. It was incredible genocide.
Welcome back to Going Underground. I'm still here with Professor of International Affairs at the Harvard Kennedy School, Stephen Walt. Professor, at end of part one, we were talking about how Biden might want to spin a genocide. I don't know when all the women and children have been killed. But one thing is for sure, Russia and China have been lockstep at the UN Security Council opposing the United States and Britain and France policy on in the Middle East. And, of course, Russia and China have been working together on the proxy war in Ukraine. Why have you insisted on calling it provoked, in a sense, in your work on Ukraine, rather than unprovoked, which is loudly shouted out almost by journalists on so-called mainstream media in your country and in NATO countries?
Again, it gets, I think, very much at the definition of what you mean by provoked. When I say the war was provoked, I mean that the United States and NATO took actions which drove Russia to ultimately decide to invade, beginning first in 2014, of course, with the seizure of Crimea, and then full-scale war in 2022. To say that the United States took actions that helped cause that does not justify what Russia did. What Russia has done is illegal. It's a violation of international law.
You said the same thing about Kosovo, presumably in the, I think it's the 25th anniversary of Yugoslavia's destruction.
That's right. And the United States invading Iraq in 2003 was a violation of international law. So I'm not defending Russia's actions. I'm trying to explain Russia's actions. And they regarded the American attempt, along with NATO, to gradually incorporate Ukraine into the Western security order, ultimately leading to NATO membership, as an existential threat. Now, we can argue about whether or not they should have seen it that way, but the point is they did, and they made that clear from 2008 forward. And we continued on this path even when they threatened to do something about it militarily. We did not take those threats sufficiently seriously. And that, again, does not justify what Putin has done. It certainly does not justify the way they've waged the war, the attacks on civilians, what are probably war crimes eventually. None of that is justified by the fact that American policy helped bring this about. And unfortunately, we did this, and the victims, the primary victims of our diplomatic and strategic mistakes and Russia's illegal invasion, are Ukrainians who are suffering.
To the last Ukrainian, as many in the Global South have observed. Why is this opinion that you're coming out with, and of course Russia denies any war crime, just says we went in to save, well, the de facto genocide of Russian speakers in eastern Ukraine, is your opinion and your perspective being is more pervasive now in Washington than it was, say, in 2022?
Well, as is often the case when a war breaks out, it's difficult to have a rational conversation about it. And I think there was people were so quick to want to blame Moscow for everything, pin this entirely on Vladimir Putin and rally as much public support for the Ukrainians as possible to even try to point out that Western actions played a role in creating this situation. I think it was very difficult politically. I think now, because there's so much evidence to support that position, that we unwittingly, unintentionally helped create this war, now people are willing to acknowledge it. And moreover, as we're reaching a point where people begin to understand that Ukraine is probably not going to win a heroic victory here, that it's almost certainly going to end up losing territory when there is a final peace agreement, peace settlement. That's, I think, encouraging people to go back and ask the question, well, how exactly did we get here? How might we have avoided this? Was there a diplomatic solution either before the war broke out or in the first few months of the war that might have avoided all of the suffering that has occurred since then?
It's all come too late. And so Biden, Blinken, and Sullivan, seem to be talking more about Keynesian militarism, okay, to the US electorate. Forget about the Ukraine, forget about all the mass killing that needn't have happened. Think about the great money being recycled that we say is going to Ukraine but will improve the lives of ordinary Americans. Has that surprised you? Usually proxy wars, whether in Central America or Latin America, they wouldn't be talked so openly about the fact they would be profitable.
Yeah, well, the former Secretary of State many years ago, Dean Acheson, once said that advocacy must be clearer than the truth. Right. And I think what's happened here is the administration very much wants to get the $60 billion of additional support for Ukraine approved by Congress. So they will pull out every conceivable argument they can think of that might win over some congressional support, maintain public support for it. I don't think they're doing this because they want Ukraine to bleed Russia forever, you know, fighting to the last Ukrainian. I think they also recognize that Ukraine is not going to be able to liberate all of its lost territory with military force. I think what they're hoping to do is keep Ukraine in the fight and improve its bargaining position. And if Biden is reelected, then in the second term, they will actually begin pushing much harder for a ceasefire there, an armistice, and an eventual peace agreement. That's not going to be difficult, or that's not going to be easy for them to do, but I think there's a certain sense of realism as to where this one is headed. They just want to make sure that Ukraine doesn't collapse between now and then.
It's getting worse and worse, isn't it? And, of course, Donald Trump said he would end it tomorrow. What are you making of the fact that certainly in the Global South, let alone in Moscow, people are drawing links, nothing has been fully established with yet, between ISIS-K, this entity, which has previously been associated with U.S. intelligence agencies, and Ukraine and the proxy war itself, let alone U.S. policy vis-a-vis Islamists in Syria and the like?
Yeah, I tend to be relatively skeptical when people draw very elaborate connections between a variety of separate phenomena. And I think one can actually...
But you wouldn't have during 9/11. That was pretty complicated. I think 9/11 was pretty complicated, wasn't it?
No, but it wasn't a complicated plot in the sense that it involved all sorts of mysterious parties. And
well, it involved the history of U.S. foreign policy in Yugoslavia, actually, let alone the Mujahideen in Afghanistan.
Yeah. Well, in any case, I think one can have a parsimonious explanation of the terror attack in Moscow, which blames it on ISIS-K, which has its own reasons for going after Moscow, given the relationship between Moscow and its Muslim populations and some of the actions Russia has taken in the past. And I don't think one has to drag in the Ukrainians or necessarily drag in the United States of America as though we had something to do with this. We did in the sense that our actions in the Middle East in past decades created the conditions in which groups like ISIS-K emerged. And in that sense, we have a certain historic responsibility here. But I would need to see some really convincing evidence before I think the United States was somehow involved in trying to arrange that, or even that the Ukrainians were involved in trying to arrange it.
Do you think this $60 billion is going to be sent to Zelensky? And how hard is it going to be for Biden? I mean, there's supposed to be elections in Ukraine in May. Zelensky's banned the church, opposition parties. Presumably he's going to ban elections that are due in May. It's going to be difficult to sell that to the American public?
I don't think the American public are going to pay that much close attention, to be honest. I think they're looking at the very big picture. How is Ukraine doing? I believe, although I can't prove it, I believe that the money will eventually be approved because at the end of the day, Republicans in Congress would like to pin what's happening in Ukraine on the Biden administration, and they don't want to get blamed if between now and the election, Ukraine loses a lot more territory, Ukraine begins to collapse militarily, et cetera. They want this all on Joe Biden's desk because they understand it's not going to look like a big success story. And so approving the aid is their way of saying, okay, we're letting you run this, and then we're going to attack you for how badly it's going come the fall in the election. And of course, that'll be a big part of Trump's pitch as well. But he doesn't want to give Biden the obvious counter to say, well, I would have been doing just fine if the Republicans in Congress had just supported this. That's why I think the aid will go through. I don't think it will alter the situation on the battlefield in any kind of decisive way. It will help keep Ukraine in the game. It will not allow them to reverse their fortunes.
And all the time, Western Europe in economic decline, shocked that the $60 billion isn't being sent. Do you think people in Western Europe generally get the feeling they've been used over this proxy war as passions for it wane in the State Department and the White House.
Yeah, I don't think they are feeling used about this. I think there are considerable concerns in Europe about what the future American commitment to European security is going to be. Europeans have been accustomed for decades to thinking of the United States as the first responder when it came to European security. If there was a problem, Washington would take care of it. I think it's in America's long-term interest for European countries to take much greater responsibility for their own security. And we're seeing a moment...
You're sounding like Trump, Professor. You know that.
No. Even a broken clock is right twice a day. But in any case, this process of Europeans taking on more responsibility should be done in a sort of cooperative, gradual way, not under the pressure of an ongoing war. But in any case, your question was, are the Europeans feeling used? I don't think that's the case. I think Europeans may be feeling somewhat uncertain about how they're going to provide for themselves if the United States is not as focused on European security as it has been for the past 50 years.
And the media reports in Western European media that Russia will then take over Poland and invade, I don't know, France? Macron might be trying to say. Why is this? Where is this hysteria coming from?
I think it's coming from an attempt to inflate a set of dangers in order to galvanize a European public response and, in some cases, to persuade Americans to do even more. This idea that the Russian army is going to finish the job in Ukraine, rest for a couple of weeks, and then start going after the rest of Europe, I think is completely absurd. First of all, the Russian army has suffered a lot. They've experienced lots of losses in Ukraine that'll take a long time to rebuild. And second, even with a sort of 3-to-1 advantage in manpower and artillery and things like that, they're having a very tough time.
I don't think they want to, in fairness, rather than the practicality.
No, that's also true. So this idea that if Putin is not stopped in Ukraine and doesn't suffer a massive defeat, that he is going to launch some blitzkrieg at Western Europe, I think is a fantasy.
And just very briefly, I know actually in Britain this week, they think China's invading Britain. Just very briefly, though, we shouldn't expect any, actually, black swan event has been in the news recently, any use of the tensions with Iran in an election year by the State Department by Joe Biden?
I certainly hope not. I mean, one of the interesting phenomena since the Gaza war began is the fact that both the United States and Iran have tried to signal to each other in various ways that they don't want this to turn into a bigger Middle East war. And they certainly don't want it to lead to a direct clash of arms between Iran and the United States. I think that makes very good sense from Washington's perspective. It also makes very good sense from Tehran's perspective. And so I am hopeful that cooler heads will continue to prevail on that front, even if there are problems elsewhere in the region that are deeply troubling.
Professor Stephen Walt, thank you.
Nice talking with you.
And that's it for the show. Our continued condolences to those bereaved by UK, US, EU armed bombing in Palestine, Lebanon, Yemen, Syria and Iraq. We'll be back on Monday with Professor Norman Finkelstein, author of The Holocaust Industry and Gaza, An Inquest into Its Martyrdom. Until then, keep in touch via all our social media if it's not censored in your country, and head to our channel, Going Underground TV on rumble.com, to watch new and old episodes of Going Underground. See you Monday.